For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
Let's just recognise the angst that we're going through. It's awful. I even see it in the health department bureaucrats. I see it in our health leaders. I see it in the community of patients that we serve. This is hell on earth at the moment. But let's just try and be a bit kind to each other and to ourselves and understand we are going through a really tough time at the moment.
That was the voice of Dr. Karen Price, the president of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. Doctors across the country are feeling the pressure as the COVID-19 pandemic and vaccine rollout continue to demand our attention. GPs are bearing the brunt of delivering COVID vaccines while trying to keep their regular practice running and safe, all against the backdrop of an environment that has seen general practice face funding cuts, increased bureaucracy, ambit claims to reduce their scope, and a maldistributed workforce that puts the heat on rural doctors. Dr. Price is in her first year as president of the college, and when we caught up, she was in lockdown in Melbourne, looking out for her members via Zoom. Where are GPs at in the process in terms of vaccine at the moment? Is every GP involved? Are you getting more numbers, or are you getting people dropping out of the rollout?
Well, I think things are pretty stable at the moment, although we will be getting more and more Pfizer. So the plan is to invite just about every GP who wants to be a vaccinator, which is a really good push, obviously. We want to have, as the government and the Vaccine Operations Centre and the logistics people, they say they want to have as many points as possible, no wrong door to get a vaccine. And given that we're all going through this terrible time at the moment, makes sense. Pfizer, and AstraZeneca, of course, is still sitting there too, but increasingly it'll be Pfizer.
Do you know what's happening in Western New South Wales? Are extra doses going out there? Are GPs being involved out there?
Yes, there's very specific requirements out there, obviously in Indigenous communities particularly. So I imagine they'll be looked at very closely, and whoever can get in there. The existing relationships are obviously what's important. So GPs and Special InReach and NACHO, of course, will be involved. So, you know, highly important area to get extra vaccines in. And from what I understand, they will be transferring some extra into there.
Are you happy with the level of communication between both the feds and the state governments with the college and with GPs in general?
Initially, I think there were some problems, but I've pushed back pretty strongly to say this is a health pandemic.
Yeah,
it's nothing else. Can we just get on with it, please? And, you know, pleasingly, that's been seems to be a better cooperation. I mean, there's always media and, you know, the wedging and tricky stuff that we have to navigate. But in by and large, that's been, I think, a bit better lately. The other thing that's been good is, you know, every time I want to, I can call the Vaccine Operations Centre. We have regular webinars with all the peak bodies talking about our various jurisdictions and what's working and what's not working, and then they try and fix it, you know, that sort of stuff. So that's all happening. Look, it's a really complex rollout, Kate. So when I see things on the forums that people are telling me about, I think, oh, I haven't heard of that one before, I feed that back. Because it's important, and the Department of Health have really wanted to try and address those issues, because obviously if one person has it, then a lot of people do. Like, for instance, another one was the AIR not uploading overseas immunisation. So, you know, that's been fed back in. You know, these gnarly things, people are really busy. Everyone's really busy. Everyone's flat chat. It's been, you know, 7 days a week. It has not been one bit of let up.
The telehealth item numbers, now obviously that's been resolved because you know, the numbers have been reinstated. A couple of the GPs said they still felt really hurt by that situation, that there was this lag time where they felt they were in a really bad place dealing with their patients over this. Is there a way of ensuring that kind of situation doesn't arise again?
We fought tooth and nail, and, you know, it goes through many layers of government. So it's not even just the health minister. It's a whole lot of financial departments as well. So these things come into play. And of course, it was, I think, personally a little bit mistimed, because maybe there was some optimism that we'd got over COVID. I suspect that's true. So we vigorously pushed back. I know Sarah Chalmers and myself talked about vulnerable communities. We talked about Indigenous communities. There were some groups who were saying that video was better, and, you know, we had a lot of tussle over that, because there are people who, you know, want to get to the technological revolution, which is great, but we're not there. We're still in COVID. We've still got people. We've still got the inverse care law. So look, the government has been really open about the fact that they want to get telehealth right. But we also have people who are doing the wrong thing in, you know, there was some startup tele dial-a-doc kind of things. And how do we protect Medicare funds so they're used ethically and appropriately for people? And this is my problem as president, trying to balance having to explain why that might occur when we're trying to use it for legitimate purposes is really tricky. So an open bucket of government money is never going to be given to anyone. So there has to be some terms and conditions. Now, this is an ongoing narrative and, you know, you can see that there's been response back to the hotspots and so forth, which has been pleasing. And I'm expecting that hopefully in December, we're going to see some more iterations of this. We're going to have to work it through. Things that don't work, things that do work, how it works for the best outcome for the patients. Knowing that the government is interested in reform, is interested in technological revolution and how that might work, because there's clearly productivity benefits for some people who don't have to leave work to go to the doctor. By and large, those vulnerable people are the ones, you know, who we have to try and somehow support. And then I've got lots of people lobbying me for to advocate for them and on their behalf. So the women's health stuff was rural access to medical termination. And that was put in with a really good pitch by Professor Daniel Matzer, which had quantitative and qualitative data about the lack of services in rural healthcare for women. These nuances, there's still some that are probably a bit unfair for some people. We just need to look at those very closely and see how we can work it so that they're open for people who need them, but not for rorting. So,
rapid antigen testing. Now, am I right in saying that the college and New South Wales Health managed to rapid antigen test all the written exam candidates?
I believe that's true, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know how that went? Was it successful in terms of sensitivity and specificity and all that sort of stuff?
Well, the rapid antigen testing is not super, super great because I think it's only about 50%. But I think it was for the purposes employed there, I think it served a particular purpose of providing yet another layer of, given that they had to have an exemption, I think, to sit. So, you know, look, the exams have been really challenging. I'm on the Council for Medical Presidents with, you know, the President of the Surgeons, President of the Physicians and so forth. They've all had major challenges with the exams. And in some cases, some of the non-GP specialists have had delayed training. And, you know, whilst there's been a lot of challenge with the RACGP exams, we at least, for most part, haven't had anyone had to delay or lengthen their training. So that's been something, even though it's been pretty awful and pretty difficult. Mm.
The NHS in the UK allows the public to buy rapid antigen tests. Do you think it should be available to the public here?
Look, UK are ahead of us. They've got, what are they up to, about 70 or 80% vaccinated, I think,
somewhere around there. Yep.
And I think read about that and I found that interesting, but it's not, again, not the be-all end-all. It provides another layer of perhaps protection because there's still going to be false negatives to it, to the extent of about 50%, I think. So it's okay, but it's useful if it picks you up. It's not that great if it misses you, but at least, you know, we get some degree of information. So, look, I think these are the things that are going to be looked at when we open up. And my understanding is that'll be around about when we get to about 70%, 80%, round about there, the government will be looking at how can we live with this bug that's not going to go away.
Does the college have input to the state governments in terms of advice for their lockdowns? You know,
I attend Victoria's, being a Victorian, with Dr. Anita Munoz. Dr. Munoz is the chair of the Victorian faculty. And I have to say the state governments have been great. They've been really interested in enabling general practice and primary care to do our bit and to work with them, which has been, you know, for considering we've had this federal-state divide for a long time. From what I gather from my other board members at the college, all of the chairs of the states have had that great interaction with their state health departments pretty much.
What advice would you give to GPs when they're talking to patients about vaccine safety and what the choices are? Does the college have a hard line about who should be getting what and when?
Our hard line is follow the ATAGI advice. Now, the ATAGI advice is recommendations. And it's a risk benefit that has to be decided with the patient on the basis of not just the patient, but also the physician comfort and also the epidemiological environment. You know, are you in a hot spot or are you okay? I mean, you know, I'll even go down to, well, are you an Uber driver or are you sitting at home on your computer all the time? Because this determines the risk. So that has to be something that the practitioner is comfortable with, as well as the patient, and the patient makes the decision. So that's our advice, following the ATAGI advice, and they're certainly following the TGA recommendations too.
I'm chatting with Dr. Karen Price, the president of the RACGP, in the middle of unprecedented times for the Australian healthcare system in general and GPs in particular. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can catch up with our previous episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts. And you can subscribe to our feed through Spotify or Apple Podcasts to make sure you don't miss any upcoming pods. If you have any questions you'd like asked or people you'd like us to interview, drop me a line at cswannell, that's C, S for Sam, WANNELL at mja.com.au. We're always keen to hear your feedback. Back to our chat. Okay, let's move to another little hotspot at the moment, speaking of CPD. The new ARPRA standards are that from 2023, GPs have to prepare a personal development plan.
Yeah.
AusDoc have run a poll and it says that, you know, 74% of GPs say that's of no value to them. 70% say it should be less than 5 hours per year when ARPA is asking for 50 hours per year.
Yeah.
71% said it would make no difference to the quality of their work, and 22% said it would make them worse doctors. What do you make of those numbers, and why is ARPA now running this show when the colleges were?
Well, ARPA have always, and the Australian Medical Council have always decided what the requirements are for all doctors. And so this is the RACGP has had gold standard, one of the highest ratings of accreditation for their CPD for years, actually recognised for that by the medical board. And they don't actually have a big problem with GPs. But there are some other colleges who they're concerned about the level of standards for CPD. So this has been applied across the board. Reflective learning, I mean, look, people are thinking that they have to sit around and do a kumbaya diary and then they quote Barwa Garba and then we get the catastrophic thinking. It could be going to a small group learning peer group thing where you sit down and talk about cases, could be going to a journal club and doing that regularly and then writing up at the end of the year. If you've done small group learning, that's what you do at the end of the session, the year. You write up what you've done, how many hours, and you know how it might have or might not have improved your practice. So it could be an audit. You might be looking at pneumococcal vaccinations, how are you going? You might do an audit. You might say, hey, look, I'm missing some of my, you know, 65-year-olds. I better institute a system to do that. There's a whole range of things that will be provided. I know the college CPD team is working really hard to make this as easy as possible transition. So I think I would say to GP colleagues out there, just hang in there. We are working with the requirements. We have to work within the requirements from the Australian Medical Council. It's legislation. We're not in charge of legislation. We just have to respond to it as best as we can, make it as good for our members as possible. Now, there's a lot of contention in this area, Kate, as you know, because of the delinking of CPD to the college. And there are commercial people out there throwing a bit of mud and muddying the waters, and that's just disappointing because GPs have got enough on their plate. We are going to retain our triennium. That's something that Anne Tonkin said to us. She's pretty happy with what we've got on offer, and I'm hopeful that we'll get there. Now, if GP colleagues do find that there's something that doesn't suit them, I hope they'll be able to find something that does suit them. And if there's a whole cohort of people who say this is useless, or I, you know, like the previous plan, which I did, I found the horrible, horrible website, like everybody else, the clunky IT. We don't want that. And we will fix it. I mean, that's part of being a member-led college. You know, we're going to work with our members to get it into a situation where it's fit for purpose and makes it as easy as possible. Will it make you a better doctor? Look, not doing any education is is probably a risk.
Yes.
I think the biggest risk to us is professional isolation. So if this makes you go and do a small group thing, then that maybe that's a good thing. If this helps you benchmark what you're doing, you know, you might have not you know, you might have missed something. I mean, it's pretty normal for all of us to go, oh, hey, I didn't know that. And I know I certainly model that on GPs down under. I go, oh, I didn't know that, because that's part of that. That is actually a point of reflection.
I know a couple of doctors have expressed concern to me about what happens to their PDP once they've written it. APRA have said that it sits with you guys and that all they see is a list of names of people who've completed their PDP. Is there a situation in which you would look at a PDP, well, you or your representative would look at a PDP and go, that's a doctor of concern, we need to report them?
Look, the non-compliance, from what I understand, it's managed by the operations team, not by the, obviously, by the president. But a non-compliant doctor is probably flagged in terms of have they submitted.
Right.
And then they'll be helped and found out why. So there might be exemptions. So for people having babies, for people whose spouse has got sick, for people who are struggling with whatever, there may be exemptions. And there'll be a lot of help given to get them over the line. So will someone be looking at their reflections on, you know, in particular things? I would think that it'll be an honor system, but I don't think we're quite across exactly how that will work in terms of audits.
Yeah.
I understand there'll be random audits from APRA to see if there is compliance. So this is,
okay.
You know, we're professionals. I haven't stopped loving learning when I get a moment to breathe, but and I really I enjoy learning new stuff, and I learn.
Yeah.
I enjoy feeling that I'm keeping up, and I enjoy feeling that I'm a competent GP, you know. And I hate it when I don't know something or it's something new. You know, that's part of being a professional. People say, "Oh, well, I could stooge it, and I could." Well, you know, why would you? Is that really professional behavior? I guess is what I'd say. You want to learn. You want to serve your patients.
How's the relationship between the college and ACRM?
Great. Kudos to Dr. Sarah Chalmers. She and I are getting on fantastic. We have, I mean, I talk about this in a maturing of the relationship. You know, we had the split. It was ugly. There was lots of chest beating. There's lots of identity stuff. You know, I'm this,
yep.
I'm that. You're a latte doctor, whatever. ACRM has got its place, and we are working cooperatively from a member's point of view. My read on the members, Kate, is members are sick of the fights, sick of all that division. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
serve us politically in any way, shape, or form. And we are working to build this from a member's point of view and from a registrar's point of view that, you know, you work with your situation the best way you can, and we're here to support you.
Can you see a day when a GP who wants to work in rural settings will need a separate fellowship?
Well, ACRM have got the Rural Generalist Pathway, of course,
mm-hmm.
and we also have the Rural Generalist Pathway, but we've got 80% of our fellows, 80% of rural doctors are RACGP
yep.
doctors, and not all of them are rural generalists. So rural generalists are particularly located in the sort of MM2s to think fives or so, and the sixes and sevens often don't have a community hospital. So there are lots of doctors with FRACGP who also have advanced skills who you'd also consider to have a scope of practice like a rural generalist. There's so many unique situations in Australia. You want a doctor who is fit for that place, and by whatever means they go to do that is going to be sufficient. And I think we need to understand that people may bolt on an extra year later on. They might have been, you know, out in their regional areas or even in city area, and they might decide to go and do rural practice after a period of time. So, you know, we want to make it easy and flexible so that people can move around a bit, so that they start to feel that they've got the skills to go where they need and want to go.
Looking beyond COVID, what do you see as the future of general practice? I'm thinking of things like, you know, we've got nurse practitioners, we've got pharmacists who want to take up some of the tasks that GPs do, immunisation, for example. We've got registered nurses who can do endoscopies. Are we going to end up with physician assistants? How do you see the next 5 years?
Look, there are big risks to general practice. I think everyone would see that. And the risk is that people see our profession as being one of tasks, a series of tasks that you can cherry pick off and give to someone else and call that general practice. It's not general practice. General practice is continuous longitudinal relational care.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not easily measured by quantified measures, although all of the research suggests that it is the best bang for buck. The World Health Organization, every bit of health funding research suggests, you know, it is.
Yeah.
So to destroy that with ambit claims for reducing the scope of the people who are doing a great job just seems pretty silly politically and economically.
Yeah.
there are areas where, you know, there are nurse practitioners in rural areas, yep, and so forth. We do have a maldistribution area that we need to look at very carefully. The future of general practice should be bright. I'm concerned by the statistic that 15% of our young graduates are choosing general practice. And I think that's something, yeah, that if unless we start seeing some genuine reform, that's going to be a big problem for every citizen of Australia.
Where would you like that reform focus?
I'd like to see general practice being the specialty of choice, where we need to see 50% of our graduates choose general practice.
That's a big ambition, Karen.
Yeah, well, it's important. It's, yeah, not one that's it's one that's been suggested. That's a figure that I haven't just pulled out. That's a figure that's been suggested as being a reasonable figure for a healthy and productive health system. We're going to need some genuine commitment to general practitioners and to generalism, and to stop seeing things in terms of simple black boxes that, yeah, are task focused. You can't break people down into boxes.
I wish I could tell you that the GPs on our staff are happy and vitalised, but they're tired and scared right now.
Yeah, no, they are. I think we all are. I think, yep, everybody, look, let's just recognise the angst that we're going through. This is, you know, it's awful. I even see it in the health department bureaucrats. I see it in our health leaders. I see it in our college. I see it in ACRM. I see it across the board on the forums. I see it in the community of patients that we serve. This is hell on earth at the moment.
Yeah.
And everyone's in the amygdala space. Let's just try and be a bit kind to each other and to ourselves and understand we are going through a really tough time at the moment.
Thank you.
Good seeing you.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.